guitar people, welcome to Have Guitar Will Travel, presented by Vintage Guitar Magazine. With your host, me, James Patrick Regan, otherwise known as Jimmy from the Deadlies. And today I'm speaking with Paul Leary, guitarist and producer from the Butthole Surfers. In our conversation, Paul talks about the documentary on the band and a recent show they did at the screening, and the demise of the Butthole Surfers and Paul's retirement. Paul describes his gear currently and throughout the run of the Butthole Surfers, including a Fender Custom Shop Strat made by John Cruz, and he takes us through the guitars that got away. Paul takes us through growing up in San Antonio and how seeing the Beatles on TV gave him the guitar bug and his guitar education playing in jazz bands. Paul discusses how he and Gibby met in college and how they started the band that eventually became the Butthole Surfers and how the name came about. Paul tells us about being produced by John Paul Jones and himself being the producer for U2, Sublime, the Meat Puppets, and the Reverend Horton Heat. Paul then discusses the rigors of touring and traveling as the Butthole Surfers, and he describes how the documentary came about. To find out more about Paul, you can go to his website, buttholesurfers.com. That's buttholesurfers.com, and the trailer to the documentary is on YouTube. Please subscribe, like, comment, share, and most of all, review this podcast. I'd really appreciate it. And please support Vintage Guitar Magazine and all the wonderful things they do for us guitar players, because they do so many wonderful things for us guitar players. Oh, and if you'd like to support the show, we have a Patreon. It's patreon.com/haveguitarwilltravelpodcast. Here's my buddy Paul. Hey there, Paul.
How you doing?
Good. What are you drinking?
Coffee.
Oh, good. Are you sober, man?
Probably about half the week.
Okay, good.
I split a bottle of wine with my wife a couple of times a week.
Okay. All right. Very good. So are the Butthole Surfers, I know you have a documentary coming out pretty soon here in just like a few weeks, but is it a viable thing? Like, are you guys still out there playing?
No.
When was the last time
you played? I'm done with that.
Yeah. When was the last time you played?
A few months ago, we got together at a screening of our documentary at the Egyptian Theater in Los Angeles, and okay. We were there for a Q&A, and then we played a surprise 3-song set after the screening.
Wow.
So that was our last show, and before that, it was probably at least a decade before that.
Wow.
Since our last real show.
And are you playing with anybody else? Are you playing in your solo shows or anything?
No. But I'm enjoying life right now. I worked my ass off for a long ass time, and now I ride my bicycle and I swim and I hang out with my wife and my cat.
Right on.
It's glorious.
Yeah. And but Gibby is out there playing.
Yeah, he's got a band. They've got like a house gig in Brooklyn, I believe.
Okay.
And he's going to come to Austin in, I think, September and play a show. He wants me to come up and play a song on stage with him, and I will probably do that.
Right on. Very good. And if you had to play, if you're going to show up at that show, what guitar are you going to bring?
I think I'm going to bring I think it's probably like an early 80s Longhorn, a Hondo Longhorn.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it's the stupidest guitar ever. It's what I used. It's what I used on the song Lady Sniff,
okay.
If you're familiar with that song.
Yes. Yep. Yep. Right on.
I kind of keep it around because, I keep it tuned down. You know, I tune it from an E all the way down to an A.
Wow.
And that's, the strings are just barely hanging on there low, but it's fun to play like that.
Sure. And how many guitars do you have, like, just sitting around home?
I don't know, not tons and tons. You know, over the years, I lost a lot of cool guitars just because I was always going through poor times. And Napster was a particularly brutal time for musicians. And I lost my first Strat, and I lost my...
Wow.
Gold Sparkle Les Paul and my Custom Shop Les Paul and a few other guitars, but I'm real happy with the guitars that I have. They, I don't play a whole lot of guitar anymore, but what I have now is my main guitar is a Stratocaster from the Custom Shop built by John Cruz. Are you familiar with him?
Of course, yes.
Yeah, my friend Kaleo from the band Pepper, he set that up for me. You know, that was a guitar that I had to wait on a waiting list for 6 months.
Yeah.
And Kaleo picked out all the details of it and wouldn't tell me what it was going to be until I actually got the guitar. And it's fabulous. The thing, it's, you know, Strats tend to be like either spankers or chimers, and this one's a chimer.
Oh, good.
And so that's what I played live for the last few years that I was playing live, and when somebody asked me to play a part on a song for a recording, that's the one I usually whip out.
Is it heavy? And or then, is it, sorry.
Pretty light. It's pretty lightweight. Yeah. You know, I played a 78 Les Paul Custom for a long time, and it was hell on my upper back. I was always having back spasms in my upper back, and I'd go to see a doctor, and he'd put me on muscle relaxers, which I fucking hate.
Yeah.
And then I just said to hell with it. I'm going back to a Stratocaster, because the Strat was what I first started playing in the Butthole Surfers. And, so I got you know, that original Strat I lost in a pawn shop a long time ago. And so now I've got this wonderful John Cruise Stratocaster. Yeah. And then my other favorite guitar that I have in my home studio is a Dan Electro. It's the same model that Jimmy Page played, except mine's the Batwing headstock version of it.
Oh wow, right on. Yeah.
And that was a real find. I bought it off of eBay about 10 or 12 years ago for like $1,000.
Wow.
And in the description it said that the finish was worn off around the edges of the neck. And so I get this guitar from eBay, and I open up the package, and the thing looked like it was brand freaking new.
Oh, right.
And I was like, oh shit, I got played. This is a reissue from Korea or whatever. No, it was the real deal, that nobody had ever played it. There was no buckle rash, no nothing.
Right on.
And that finish that was rubbed off on the edges of the neck wasn't rubbed off at all. That's just the way they painted all of those guitars.
Okay.
And it sounds great. And then my next favorite guitar would be probably a mid-60s Sears Silvertone Dan Electro.
Sure.
Which is like 7/8 scale.
Yeah, yeah.
Which makes it real fun to play.
But you grew up in San Antonio?
Yes.
Yeah. And was music in your house all the time? Or how did you come about playing guitar?
Well, I was interested. You know, when I was 5, I saw Elvis. And so I talked my dad to buy me a guitar. The first guitar he bought for me was $5 from Mexico, and it probably had four strings on it. And I played it enough to where when I was 6, he bought me a regular real acoustic guitar.
Okay.
And then I saw the Beatles on Ed Sullivan, and I saw all those screaming girls, and I was like, Dad, you got to buy me an electric guitar. I got to get in on that action.
Yeah.
And so he bought me a Kalamazoo electric guitar. It was powder blue with a white pick guard. It was just gorgeous, and wasn't that great of a guitar or anything, and a little Kalamazoo amp that went with it. I played in a couple of school bands in elementary school and got to play in front of the school.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah.
Did you have a guitar teacher? Were there people around you that played guitar as well?
No, I started taking guitar lessons like around age 6 or something, and I had this old man that was teaching me how to play Baby Elephant Walk and stuff like that. And he was mean. He was mean. He was always ragging on me for not practicing enough.
Sure.
And I got tired of that. And then I didn't take lessons until like junior high or high school. I started taking guitar lessons from a San Antonio rockin' legend named Galen Niles, and I would take albums into his space, and he'd put it on and figure out how to play it, and then show me how to play it. And so I kind of learned from that how to figure out other people's songs and play it. You know, I was able to play the entire Grand Funk Live double album from start to finish eventually, and things like that. So that was a lot of fun. So I played in you know, garage bands through high school.
Yeah, just slowing you down a little bit. Did you play like school dances and stuff with the bands you played in high school?
No, not the rock bands. I also played in stage band
high
school, and we would do gigs. Like, we'd go down to the downtown hotels and play Sunday brunch and that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And school gatherings that we would play sets, and the bandmaster was really cool, but he was always telling me to turn it down because I had like a, you know, a badass Fender Twin reverb that was way too loud needing it for. And I actually played through two amps at once, that and an old Ampeg Reverber Rocket 2.
Wow.
And I had a Echoplex, or I think that's what it was. And I was able to put the dry signal to the twin and the echo through the Ampeg. And so it was a little bit trippy for back then, but stage band was a lot of fun because I learned how to read charts that were written by like horn players for guitar. And sure. So that was challenging, and a lot of weird chords and a lot of stage band songs.
Yeah. Yeah. And so, I mean, did you learn those chords and stuff?
Yeah.
Right on. That's right on.
Yeah. That was the other thing Galen Niles helped me with. I would take these ridiculous charts with these chords that had names a half a block long, and and he'd figure them out and show me how to finger them on the guitar. So that helped me out quite a bit.
Yep. And I mean, apart from Elvis and the Beatles, who were you listening to? And Grand Funk, who are you listening to?
Oh, like Creedence Clearwater Revival, Marty Robbins.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
You know, growing up in the 60s, it was like, you had your favorite bands and you tended to listen to just that and nothing else. And, or at least that kind of music. And I'm always amazed that kids these days listen to all kinds of music. And sure, that's just something I never considered back in the day. Cause you know, that's, if you didn't listen to the Beatles, what was your alternative? It was like, Frankie Valli or Frank Sinatra or something like that. And I wasn't going to go there, but now, you know, there's so much out there and kids get to really take advantage.
Oh yeah. Yeah. It's amazing how many, you know, there's kids out there probably in their late teens or early 20s that are listening to you.
Bless their hearts.
And so once you got out of high school, what'd you do?
Then I went to college and put the guitar down and didn't touch it for 4 years.
Wow.
I was like, I thought I studied art and I wanted to be the next Pablo Picasso, but I wasn't good enough to be the next Pablo Picasso. And so I kind of switched gears a little bit and tried to get a minor in business. And I thought I could become a salesperson for Xerox or a stockbroker or something. And
wow.
And I wasn't cut out for that at all. I didn't get a job coming out of college, but I did strike up a friendship with Giddy Haynes.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, we would hang out and smoke pot and listen to, you know, Joy Division and Devo and all that stuff. And that was a lot of fun. He turned me on to a lot of new wave and punk rock music. You know, we listened to the Ramones and,
yeah.
And I graduated a year before he did and started working at a lumber yard. And he graduated accounting student of the year at Trinity University and went on to get a job at Pete Marwick and Mitchell, which was at the time the largest accounting firm in the world.
Uh-huh.
But he kind of figured out that he hated it. You know, he hated auditing and he wanted to be in a band. And so he started playing music at a friend of ours, Scott Matthews' house, who fancied himself a drummer.
Uh-huh.
And a fellow named Scott Stevens, who had a guitar, and he kept trying to talk me into going over there and playing with him. And I put him off for a long time, and then one day I broke down and went over there. You know, I was like, boy, the lumberyard is just not working for me. And so I started playing music over at Scott Matthews' house, and before long, we kind of had a band and started playing at art galleries in San Antonio.
Wow.
This was before we were calling ourselves the Butthole Surfers. I think we started out as the Dick Clark Five, and then we became we would switch our name at every show, and then we were the Dick Gas Five, and then we were the Ashtray Baby Heads, and then we were 9 Foot Worm Makes Own Food, and then we were the Right to Eat Fred Astaire's Asshole, which morphed into the Inalienable Right to Eat Fred Astaire's Asshole. And, and then we were like, we drove up to Austin to go take our girlfriend skinny dipping at the lake. And on the way back, we stopped by the punk rock club in Austin and ran into the Big Boys there, which was the punk band of the time in Austin. And they asked if we'd play, you know, some songs before their set, and we were like, sure. So we called up the drummer and got him to come up with a drum kit, and we played a few songs at this club before the big boys played, and then we did that again. And the bass player, Chris Gates, knew that we changed our name every show. And this one time, he didn't know what our band name was. And he was introducing us on the stage. And he knew we had a song called Butthole Surfers. So he introduced us as the Butthole Surfers. And, you know, we were kind of looking around like, okay. And then at the end of the night, the club owner gave us $50.
Wow.
And we were like, we're going to be rich. And so we stuck with that band name. And
yeah,
it only took 20 years, but but yeah.
And if I take you back, so when you were playing in stage band, what kind of guitar were you playing in stage band?
I had a Les Paul Custom, I believe it was. It had the slightly narrower pickups. It was a Sunburst.
Oh, the Deluxe?
Yeah, the Deluxe.
Okay, yeah, right on.
So that was pretty swanky back then, you know. Sure. I worked at a Dairy Queen and saved up my money to buy that guitar. That's Milo.
Look at Milo. Hey, that's cute. That's a great looking cat.
He wants me to take him outside. He's going to have to wait.
So when you were playing, when you played that first show, when you were playing all those shows leading up to where you played the first show as the Butthole Surfers, what were you playing then?
They had a Gibson, I think it was called a Sonix.
Yeah.
It had like a fiberglass body. Sure. It was kind of shaped like a Les Paul, but it didn't have an arch top. It was a cheapo version of a Les Paul.
Yeah.
And I played that for a while. And then I was still working at the lumberyard and saving up money. And then I had a dream one night that I was playing a white Stratocaster with a black pick guard, and I woke up convinced that that was my destiny, and I drove from San Antonio to Austin to a Ray Hennig's music store in Austin, Texas, and walked in and saw it on the wall. There Wow. It was, the white Stratocaster with a black pick guard, and I bought it on the spot, and that's what I played on our early Butthole Surfer records.
Right on. And what were you playing through as far as amps?
Let's see. Oh, I had this cool amp. It was I can't remember exactly what year. It was an early 1960s Fender twin amp.
Wow.
Not a twin reverb. It was blonde with a brown face and the cream knobs. And that was a really cool amp. You know, I played that on the first three albums.
Uh-huh.
And then I saw... You know, I was a big fan of Scratch Acid back then, and I was at a show where Scratch Acid was playing, and their guitar player Brett Bradford was playing through a Fender concert amp.
Yep.
And I just thought it sounded so fucking good, and so I was like, oh, I gotta sound like that. Uh-huh. So I went and traded my beautiful brown face Fender twin amp for a new modern Fender concert amp and a red sparkly Telecaster. I still have the Telecaster, but the amp is long gone.
Yeah. And did you go? I mean, you guys were not making money hand over fist, but did you go through a lot of gear and through the early years of the band?
Well, as much as we could afford. I didn't have a whole lot of different amps or anything like that, or guitars. I think after I was playing on the Stratocaster, the next guitar I bought was the Hondo Longhorn. It's brown and ugly as hell, and that I used on Lady Sniff. And, you know, that was a super cheap guitar.
And what about Destruction? Like, I mean, you guys were known for having some pretty outrageous shows. Did your gear ever get, you know, messed up while you're playing?
Oh, yeah. Later I had a couple of Gibson Firebirds. I had a white Firebird and a reddish brown Firebird. Yeah. And I was pretty rough on those, and eventually they'd just, you know, I would pop the neck off. So I don't have those anymore. I broke a few nice guitars, and then we figured out that if we'd go to the pawn shops and buy some cheap guitars and use those for the songs that were rough on the guitars, that we could just smash up all the guitars we wanted.
Yeah.
So did that for a while.
What about amps? Did you go through a lot of amps?
I tried a lot of different things. After the Fender concert amp that I traded for my Fender twin amp, I'm trying to think of what came after that. I can't remember exactly what year. It was a Marshall JTM-45.
Okay.
It was before they came up with the scroll Marshall lettering. It had like a gold rectangular plaque with Marshalls in kind of 20s style lettering.
Yes.
And a red 8x10 Marshall cabinet.
Wow.
And that thing sounded freaking great. Yeah. When I got poor, I had to sell that. And then I think the next thing I had was a Bogner.
Yeah.
I had and then as we started making money, I bought a couple of Bogners, and I would have, two Bogner half stacks on stage.
Oh, wow. Is this like in the 2000s?
No, that would have been in the... That would have been in the 90s, early 90s, probably.
Wow. So right.
Oh, and I played Mesa Boogie a lot, too. I had the Mark IVs.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think I used that on the Independent Worm Saloon album that we recorded with John Paul Jones.
Yeah, yeah. How did you guys get hooked up with John Paul Jones?
Well, we signed with Capitol, and by then somebody pointed out to me that, we were the top grossing independent touring act on the road in America one year, and that freaked me out. I was like, holy shit, it sounds better than it was. But so we were doing well, and it got us in the interest of major labels. And when Capitol came along, it was like, no way I'm passing up Capitol. That was the home of Grand Funk Railroad and the Beatles and Frank Sinatra and Dean Martin and Creedence Clearwater. I mean, it's just like, there's no way I'm going to pass up a chance to be on Capitol.
Sure.
And then we had the interest of a lot of top producers that wanted to produce our album. And we were mulling over, God, do we want Joe Ciccarelli or do we want Michael Beinhorn or, And then Lee Lust, our A&R representative at Capitol, came up with John Paul Jones and contacted John Paul Jones to see if he was interested before he even threw the name at us. And once I heard that, I was like, I'm not going to my grave having passed up a chance to work with John fucking Paul Jones.
Yeah, yeah.
And so that's how we got hooked up with him. And boy, that was great. I mean, he was a whole lot of fun to work with. And he taught me about producing records, and that's something I carried with me for, ever since.
Yeah. And you're still producing people right now, right?
I've slowed down quite a bit.
Okay.
I started producing records in the glory days of 2-inch analog, 24 track tape. And, that was a whole different ball of wax than it is today. And my memories of that are waiting forever for the tape to rewind, and then how heavy the tape boxes were to carry around.
Yes.
And couldn't wait for digital, but God, that tape sounded so good.
Yeah.
But then Pro Tools came out, and everybody was switching to digital, and then I felt like a silent film star trying to transition to talkies, and that was rough. And it took me a while to master Pro Tools and editing and all that stuff. But eventually I got pretty good at it.
Yeah. Can you name some of the people you produced?
The first I produced Butthole Surfer early albums, obviously. And or I don't know how much you know about that, but I was a guy that liked to be in the studio. And, there was this bluegrass band in Austin called Bad Livers, and I used to go watch them play every week at the Saxon Pub, and they were a lot of fun. They would play everything from traditional bluegrass kind of songs to Hendrix and Motorhead. And, and they were super good. And one night I approached them and said, hey, if you let me produce an album, I'll pay for the studio time. And they agreed to that. And so I produced an album that came out on Touch and Go.
Wow.
It's called Delusions of Banger by the Bad Livers. And, you know, it sold a few copies, nothing big or anything. And, we were good friends with the Meat Puppets, and the Meat Puppets signed to a major label before we did. And, they were getting ready to record their second major label album, and they wanted John Paul Jones. And so they asked me if I would contact John Paul Jones to see if he would produce a record for him. And I was like, sure, I bet he will. I played you guys for him a lot when we were in the studio together. John Paul Jones turned him down.
Oh,
and I gave him the bad news, and they were like, well, you know, we like that Bad Livers album you produced. Would you produce our album? And I was like, hell yeah. They were my favorite band in the world at the time. And so that was a big break for me. I produced an album called Too High to Die, and it had a radio hit called Backwater on it that was like played, got tons of airplay and went gold and had a radio hit. And so that kind of like punched my ticket. And the next thing that came along was working on my second Meat Puppets album that I was producing a couple of years later in Arizona. And I had a rental car and was driving back and forth from the hotel to the studio. And there was this AM radio station in Phoenix that played punk rock music.
Oh, wow.
And so I kept it on that. It was great. I've never heard an AM punk rock radio station before. They played great music. And one of the songs they played a lot was Date Rape by Sublime.
Uh-huh.
And I love that song, and I love the guitar solo and everything about it. And I drove home from the studio listening to that one evening and got to my hotel room, and my agent called me up and said, hey, there's this band called Sublime. You have any interest? And I was like, fuck yeah. They like the Meat Puppets Too High to Die album. And so that was a direct line between paying to work for an album and getting a first job and then a second job that, you know, has sold many, many millions of records.
Yeah.
And, you know, that was like towards the end of the analog days, the end of the big budget record days. And so I was real lucky to cash in on that.
Is there like a camaraderie amongst punk bands?
Well, you know, we don't hang out together.
No.
But a camaraderie of the heart, yeah. You know, in the days that we were playing, you know, we were all friends, you know, like especially the Texas punk bands like the Dicks and the Big Boys and the Stickmen with Ray Guns. And then, you know, we toured with quite a lot of bands.
Sure. Yeah.
And I never thought of it as camaraderie so much as, you know, there we were.
Yeah. And were there towns, I mean, you guys played everywhere, but were there places that were more receptive to you, like San Francisco or New York?
Yeah, you know, L.A. was tough to crack at first, but San Francisco was easier.
Do you play at
Detroit?
In San Francisco was the Mubuhay Gardens?
Yeah, and then it was, I can't remember if it was upstairs or downstairs from the On Broadway. There was two clubs in the same building, and we played both of them.
Yeah, On Broadway's upstairs.
There was one of those shows that they oversold, and the fire department came in as we were starting to play our first song, and they shut the show down evacuated the building, and there was a riot and good times. Yeah, it was at the Mabuhay, I think, that after a show I was approached by a teenage girl who had her own fanzine. Everybody had a fanzine back in the day, and she wanted to interview me. And so, sure. And her first question was, so don't you feel horrible about charging $6 a ticket to these poor punk rockers that are used to paying $5 for a ticket?
Oh my God.
And you've sold out, you're doing it for the money. And I was like, honey, you're going to go home tonight and sleep in a bed, and I'm going to go to some stranger's house and wake up next to their cat box in the morning. So, you know, save that for someone else. Yeah. You know, we kind of had an expensive light show that we carried around. At that point we had 16 millimeter projectors that we were showing penis reconstruction surgery movies and Charlie's Angels and one of those Highways of Death movies they would show you in driver's ed class make you want to drive carefully, all that stuff. We'd have like three projectors showing movies at the same time, and And, you know, that's a little costly. You'd have to hire somebody to set it up and run it and all that other stuff. So,
were you guys?
So that was our justification for charging $6 a ticket.
Were you guys traveling in a station wagon or in our van, or what were you driving in back then?
Well, our first tour vehicle was a 72 Chevy Nova.
Wow.
And we had we were a five piece band, and we had a pit bull.
Oh my God!
It was a sweet, really sweet animal that we rescued from a dog pound. She was everybody's best friend, and we chainsawed the back seat out of it and put plywood down so that three people and a dog could lay down in the trunk back seat area.
Oh my gosh!
And then we towed a U-Haul trailer, and that's We toured the East Coast like that, and then kind of ended up in New York for a little while, and then decided, you know, we really need a proper van. So our first van that we bought was from a gypsy in Queens. It was a like a short Chevy van that had a six cylinder engine and only four of the cylinders worked.
Oh my God.
and we had to add oil to it literally every 15 or 20 minutes.
Oh my God.
And we would buy pallets of oil, and half the van, you know, there would be equipment and people and the dog, and then stacks and stacks of oil. And we were always, and you could see us from the space shuttle driving down the street. The smoke that came out of it was spectacular.
Yeah.
And eventually enough oil caked all over the engine to where it caught fire while we were driving it. And
oh, man. Was there ever a time when you guys could, like relax and take in some of the stuff, you know, yeah, that you've been putting out? You know what I'm trying to say. Just be able to reap the stuff you sowed.
Well, I don't really know how to answer that question other than I feel like I'm reaping it right now.
Sure.
Because, you know, I still get paid for that fucking shit. 40 years ago, 40 to 30 years ago is the stuff that I, you know, make a living off of today.
Wow.
And so, yeah.
Do you get, are you getting royalties from the Sublime record?
Oh, yes.
All right.
Sublime has been wonderful to me.
Yeah.
Very wonderful to me. It's great. Twice a year, baby.
Right on. I'm glad to hear that. You guys achieved quite some fame as the Butthole Surfers. You guys never had a proper tour vehicle or anything? Did you ever have a tour bus?
Oh, yeah. You know, after that, the van caught fire. We bought another van. It was an old Dodge extended van that we bought from a plumbing company, and it said something like Athens Plumbing Company on the side, and we toured around with that for a few years. It didn't have a working gas gauge, so we were always running out of gas in the middle of the night and having to hitchhike to the gas station, and it had a hole in the floorboard. I can remember driving in the coldest cold front ever in the South's history with cold air blowing through the floorboard and trying to wrap my feet in sleeping bags, trying to drive. I did all the driving for my band.
It was like
I had a Gibby drive once, and that didn't work out so well. We were all asleep, and I could feel him pulling off the highway into a convenience store, and he gets out to go buy a cigarette or whatever he was going to go buy, and all of a sudden I feel the van starting to roll back out onto the highway.
Oh,
he didn't put the parking brake on, and I'm like yelling at King, our drummer, to hit the brake. I'm like, hit the brake, and King's like, which one's the brake?
Oh no.
And I just like hit them all.
Oh man.
Yeah. that van had problems. The night we got our first record deal was in San Francisco. We were driving to San Francisco from Los Angeles, and we were going over the Bay Bridge, and the fuel pump started going out, and the thing was sputtering, and it's about to die, and it was rush hour traffic, and I thought, oh my God, if we don't make it to the top of the hill, we're going to die. And it barely made it to the top of the hill on the bridge.
Uh-huh.
The engine died, and we coasted down the bottom of the Bay Bridge and rolled off the first exit.
Oh my God.
And rolled to a stop in front of this building that said Tool and Die in front.
Sure.
And we're like, and we're sitting there going, what the fuck are we going to do? And I look over there and we see all these punk rockers loading drums and amps into this Tool and Die building. So we got out and started unloading our stuff, you know, going in there with them until this woman, you know, came up to us and goes, who are you guys? And we're like, we're the Butthole Serpents. She's like, you're not playing here. And we, you know, we started crying. Oh, we don't got any money and our van's broken. And she's like, well, you can play three songs.
Wow.
And so, yeah, this place was a fire trap. I mean, you'd go into the building and then to get into the, where the venue was, there was a hole in the floor with a step ladder. And so you had to, that's where the audience and everybody had to go down, up and out of this hole in the floor. We had our three songs, but the Dead Kennedys showed up. You know, they were like a surprise guest and they played that night. Biafra saw our three songs that we were allowed to play and signed us to Alternative Tentacles based on that.
Wow. Right on. Right on.
Yeah. And then our drummer and bass player quit the band right after that. So we came back to San Antonio with no drummer, no bass player, but we had a record deal.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so we started recording. It was just Gibby and I, and, we were trying to talk friends of ours who played drums into coming over and playing on some of our songs. And the drummer for the Marching Plague played on a couple of songs and then didn't want to play on any more. So we were, you know, Gibby and I were working on this song, and all of a sudden there's a knock on the door at the studio, and we open it, and there's this weird disco-looking dude. I mean, he had sideburns and short with tall platform disco shoes and disco bell-bottom pants. And he was like, hey, I heard music coming through the door. And can I play drums on a song?
Wow.
And yeah, we're like, hell yeah, you can play drums on a song. Come on in. And there's a song on our first EP called Hey. And he played the drums on that song. And he insisted on recording all the drums one at a time, starting with the hi-hat and then the kick drum and then the snare.
Oh.
Yeah. And then, and we were all marveling at this process. We were pretty greenhorn in the studio at that point. Pretty new to it all, and it's like, oh, this guy knows what he's doing, you know. And he records drums, and it's a song on our album. And turned around, and he was gone. He walked out the door, and we never knew his name.
Wow.
And then King Coffee joined the band shortly after that and played on like three songs or something on that EP. Uh-huh. And we had us a drummer.
Right on. You've seen the documentary, obviously. Did you produce the documentary?
No, that was directed by Tom Stern, who was a friend of ours from the 80s.
Okay.
He and his good friend Alex Winter, who's Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure,
sure.
Alex Winter, they wanted to make a movie starring the Butthole Surfers. So they came to Austin to make a trailer.
Uh-huh.
And it's on YouTube right now. I don't know if it's called Coming to Texas or Texas Barbecue or something, but it also stars John Hawks, who's Academy Award nominated actor, and
wow.
he played a dad, and he had a wife and a young son, and the storyline is them driving to Texas, and they run into us and decide they want some of our barbecue, and so they pull over and Gibby or King or lures the son into a shed, and they butcher him and barbecue him and serve him up to the parents. And
oh man,
it's really stupid movie. And so it was the trailer. They wanted to make a full length movie starring the band. It was kind of based on that story they did, and it was like Fox or some big company bought it, and then immediately said, "Well, the Butthole Surfers aren't going to be in that movie." They replaced us with Keanu Reeves, Mr. T, Randy Quaid, Brooke Shields.
Oh, wow.
It was an all-star cast, and it's super slapstick funny. You know, it's like up there with Airplane or something. And then the president of Fox that liked that movie got fired and replaced with somebody that hated that movie, so it never came out.
Oh man!
And although like 5 years ago, Disney bought the warehouse that the tapes that the film was stored in, and they were going to clear out that warehouse and burn all the movies. And somebody saw the copy of that movie. It's called Freaked.
Okay.
And I think it's out now. I think, you know, they finally had a release. But before it was released, they did a screening of it at the Egyptian Theater in Hollywood. And Tom Stern called me up to see if I'd be interested in coming and playing guitar to the movie as it's screening. And, I'd done some, you know, music bits for the movie. So I was like, sure, that sounds like fun. They had an amp and a guitar in front of the screen that I would pop up there like four times during the movie and play along with the movie.
Right on.
And I was staying at his house, and he was like, you know, would you be interested in a Butthole Surfers documentary? And I was like, it just all of a sudden the bell went off in my head, because we've been approached by a number of people over the years, and I just never was excited about a documentary. But the thought of Tom Stern, our good friend, doing that, and I knew how talented he was. He's a really funny guy, and a really funny writer. And so he started working on that like 5 years ago.
Okay.
And, you know, started with a GoFundMe or whatever you call those things.
Sure.
And he got enough money to get off the ground. And then eventually got the backing of a rich guy named Derek Rossi, who founded the pharmaceutical company Moderna.
Yeah.
He's like a co-inventor of the COVID vaccine.
Okay.
And turns out he's a fan of the Butthole Surfers. He saw us play in Toronto when he was in college.
Wow!
And so he ended up bankrolling the movie, and now we're close friends. He's a fucking fun guy to hang out with.
Sure.
So that was a long movie in the making, and Tom did a fantastic job. It turned out way better than I could have imagined. It's better than the actual story itself, because he was smart enough to take his time, and he interviewed the band over and over and over. And there were challenges, like, you know, Gibby's really funny in an interview. You know, you'll ask him a question and he'll just go off in space. But which was good, except Tom wanted answers to the questions. And so he kept asking him until finally Gibby opened up and revealed details of a childhood trauma he experienced that nobody knew about.
Uh-huh.
And suddenly things made more sense about Gibby and where he was coming from.
Sure.
And Tom Stern hired a really good editor, and the editing, the way it's edited, really makes the movie fun to watch. You know, I've seen some rock documentaries where you see talking heads and famous people talking about the band and blah, blah, blah. And it can just be boring as piss.
Yeah.
And he didn't do that. He was telling a story, and he would just show little clips of all these people he interviewed, and it turned out really funny. And until, you know, the end where Gibby opened up about his childhood trauma, and then the loss of our second drummer girl Teresa, who died of emphysema,
uh-huh.
And kind of like five people that were in the movie died before the movie even came out.
Wow.
So it started to feel like there was a curse.
Yeah.
And then to follow up on the five people in the movie that died, Derek Rossi was friends with Rob Reiner and his wife.
Yeah.
You know, he's an investor in Castle Rock Entertainment, and he finally got Rob Reiner to watch the fucking movie.
Uh-huh.
And Rob Reiner watched it with his wife and called up Derek Rossi after he watched it, and Derek wasn't there to take the call, but he left a voicemail where him and his wife are on speakerphone going on and on about how great the movie is and how it's the best rock documentary they'd ever seen. And then that night they were murdered by their son.
God. Oh, I'm sorry.
So that was the last movie they ever watched. So yeah. there's some weird things about that movie and the people in it and the people that watched it.
Yeah. So it comes out June 26th. Is that right?
I don't know when the movie comes out. I've been waiting for word. Supposedly they're on the verge of some kind of deal. I know it's going to have some kind of limited theatrical release. And then I assume streaming.
Yeah.
We have an album coming out later in June.
Oh, do you really? Okay. Is it,
yeah.
Is there new material or old material, or?
It's old material. It's when we were after I can't even remember the name of the album we put out on Capitol. It was after Independent Worms, Electric Larryland.
Okay.
Our follow up to the hit Pepper, we recorded it and mixed it and mastered it and commissioned Mark Ryden to do artwork for it, and it was all ready to go. Capitol was ready to go. They sent out promo copies on CD and cassette tape.
Uh-huh.
And then our manager started doing dope again.
Oh no!
After years of sobriety, and I wasn't getting along with the new president of the label, Gary Gersh, and they eventually got tired of dealing with us and decided they weren't going to put the record out.
Oh man!
And so there we were. They weren't putting our record out, but they wouldn't drop us from our contract. So we were like in limbo for a couple of years.
Yeah.
That was like the worst 2 years of my life, where we couldn't, you know, record, put out an album, and eventually Hollywood Records came along and bought the project from Capitol.
Cool.
But before they would put it out, they insisted that some songs get dropped and some new songs get added, and the songs that were there were going to get rearranged and remixed and all that. And that was a very painful process for us, and we really couldn't say no, because I mean that was the only way to get out of our conundrum.
Yeah.
And so that album came out. It was called The Weird Revolution, and it didn't go over so great, and we didn't even like it. and then a couple of years ago, I was going through the Butthole Surfer storage space, and we had a whole bunch of tapes in the back, and I was going through our tape catalog, and I ran into the 2-inch 24-track multi-tracks from those sessions.
Uh-huh.
And I was like, God, I would love to mix that in my home studio and put that out. And so contacted Hollywood Records to see if they would, you know, they technically owned it.
Sure.
And I contacted them to see if they would let us put it out, fully expecting them to say no, but to their credit, they said yes.
Oh, right on.
And we got it on paper, so I brought it home and mixed it in my home studio. Didn't add anything, didn't take anything off, and did it, you know, as close to the original way as possible, except I think it sounds better.
Sure.
And now it's finally coming out the way that we wanted it to come out. So we're very excited about that.
Yeah, right on, right on. Well, I look forward to hearing it. And Paul, it's been wonderful speaking with you. I really appreciate this time. And I really want to see the documentary as well. I can't wait to see that.
I hope you enjoy it. You know, it got really good reception at the, you know, so was it film festivals around the world, everywhere from Australia and Tokyo to Europe and places like that. And it's gotten a lot of standing ovations. And so I'm really excited for it to finally come out.
Yeah. Right on, right on. Well, thanks. Thank you, Paul. Nice to meet
well,
you.
Well, thanks for talking to me. And I look forward to seeing the Vintage Guitar Magazine.
Yeah, right on. Thank you, sir. Have a wonderful evening.
Cheers.
Bye-bye. Thanks for listening to Have Guitar Will Travel. You can catch up on all the things I'm doing at thedeadlies.com. And I'm on all the social media platforms as well. And please support Vintage Guitar and all the wonderful things they do, because they do many, many wonderful things for us guitar players. Thanks. Please subscribe. Please tell a friend. And I'll see you guys next week. Bye, guys. Thank you.